I'll be here.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee, March 25, 2004. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Blaine. Ellison. Fuller. Hillstrom.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Lesh. Lippman.
Here.
Meslow. Murphy.
Here.
Paymar.
Here.
Paul.
Here.
Rhodes. Soderstrom.
Here.
Strand.
Here.
Tao.
Here.
Walls.
Here.
Chair notes for the record the presence of a quorum. Committee, we will first today, we will first take, we have six scheduled testifiers who want to offer, and we've asked them to come forward with public testimony on the sex offender and judiciary finance omnibus bill. And after we've concluded that, and I think we've scheduled roughly about 40 minutes for the, that testimony, then we will take up the sex offender and judiciary finance omnibus bill for committee discussion of amendments and for action. We have this room for the balance of the day. We do have session at 3 o'clock. If we are not concluded by noon, we will take about a half-hour break. It's my intention that we will conclude in time to all of us make session on time at 3 o'clock. So with that, let's go to the public testimony. It's now approximately 10:30. And I have, first off, Chris Lang, citizen listed. Sir, would you come forward? That you have a seat at the table. We are, this isn't a meeting where we are tape recording, so that there will be a public record, so therefore I would need to ask you to state your name and proceed to testify, if you will.
Christopher Lang. I'm Drew Jadine's boyfriend. There's her picture there with me. That's my favorite picture of us. Unfortunately, that's all I have right now of her. She's still missing, as everybody knows, I'm sure, by now. But I'm here to basically to do whatever I can for her. I'm kind of her voice now. She can't be here, so I'm here for her. Wherever she is, I'm sure she'll appreciate whatever I can try to do for her. Basically, she was abducted by a level 3 sex offender. That's who they have in custody anyway, and there's pretty strong evidence against him, as everybody's seen. It was his fourth offense, and on his third, he multiply raped a woman and stabbed her with a knife. She got away. He served 23 years in prison for it. And when he got out 6 months later, he took my girlfriend. So for 23 years, what do you think he was thinking about the whole time? And what was done in there to rehabilitate him? And if there was anything that was done to rehabilitate him, how well did it really work? Because 6 months later, after serving 23 years in prison, he did the same damn thing again. That's his fourth offense. And it's possible that she's dead. So four times until this guy is going to get what he deserves, which in my opinion is life in prison or the death penalty, whatever. I know that that doesn't work unless it's you know, proven she was taken across state lines and everything. But it's ridiculous that this guy wasn't put away for life after this crime. And it's sad because she'd be here right now and I wouldn't be here with her, we'd be somewhere else because we wouldn't be talking about sex offenders because I'm not supposed to know anything about that stuff. None of us are. But that's a perfect world, and it's not a perfect world. These people are out there, and it's proven time and time again that they keep reoffending. I've been doing research on level threes just in Minneapolis alone. There's 52 of them that are residences in the Minneapolis area. A lot of them are completely unsupervised because they've served their time, and they're not even being watched. And the crimes that they've committed are just unbelievable. You can go on the internet and look them all up. You can see their mug shots, their birthdays, everything. You can see where they're at, and you can see the crimes that they've committed, from infants to, you know, infants to elderly women to a rape at a bus stop using a brick as a weapon, and this guy is out there somewhere. It's just, where do we draw the line? Because to me, they're the sickest crimes in the world. Taking someone right off the bat, just taking someone alone, to me, should put you in prison for life, because your intent when you physically take someone from their life, like Drew, just trying to go home from the mall, just trying to live her life and just go home. Instead, she gets taken, put in a car, and then who knows what after that. But your intent for taking someone alone is not good. You know, it involves rape, it involves murder, it involves rape and murder. There's no other reasons for people to take people. You don't take people in this world. And if this bill will make sure that, I know that there's parameters around what crime needs to be committed to be put away for life, and I understand that there's a gray area there, but in my eyes, if you commit a crime against a woman or a young man or whatever it is with a weapon, Even if you don't kill that person, if you harm them in any way, and it's in a rape situation, you're going away for life. Because the mentality it takes to do something like that in the first place is sick. And who isn't going to be put away for life if it's not these guys? It's something needs to be done, because the gal I love and wanted to spend my life with is missing. And I pray every day for her return, but I'm also prepared for the worst because I've seen the evidence that everyone has seen, and I know where this could be going, but I still have faith. But it's just sad that all I have now is pictures and memories, and she should be here. And she could have been here if a bill like this had been passed years ago. For this guy's third crime, he'd be still sitting rotting in prison. So I encourage everybody to really think about these offenders, because they're not like normal people. They're not like you and I. They don't think like us. They're just, I truly believe there are some people that are born with this illness. Their wires aren't connected right. You know, they have this mentality of, I see pretty girl, I take pretty girl, I kill pretty girl. And that's how they think. They're called predators because that's how they act. And that's what they are, and that's what they need to be treated like, animals. And animals stay in cages. Thanks.
Mr. Lang, thank you. Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal, Department of Public Safety. And Mary Ellison, you can come up at the same time, Executive Director, Office of Justice Programs, Department of Public Safety. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking Mr. Rosenthal to come before us. I asked for him to come before us because I would like to know how the money that is on page 1, line 30 of the spreadsheet, how he is going to, I believe that makes his department completely funded, and I'd like to know how that money will be used.
Give us your name, sir, and then answer the question.
Chairman Smith and members of the committee, Representative Murphy, my name is Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal with the Department of Public Safety. The program that we call residential inspections last year in the budget cut was cut in lieu of fees for hotels, motels, and resorts. At the time, we didn't know the exact extent of the exemption that was also placed on certain types of occupancies. We now know that to be major. This funding will essentially replace this program, make it substantially whole back to, I'll just use a date of June of 2003. I would just, I could answer any questions in terms of the types of inspections or the programs, but this essentially puts us back into inspecting all of the hotels, motels, resorts, the daycares, the camps, the other types of inspections, residentially as opposed to commercial business that we did prior to that particular time.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Rosendahl, will how many times will a hotel or how often will a hotel or motel be inspected then? And will this allow you to add more inspectors, or will you keep the same number of inspectors you already have?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Chairman Smith, Representative Murphy, and members, the funding that this will provide us would put us back into the scheme of state law that requires these hotels, motels, and resorts to be inspected once every 3 years. We will be able to achieve that on all hotels, motels, and resorts with this money. And in terms of inspections, inspectors, we are down substantially the number of inspectors currently, so that funding would allow us to go back to the number of inspectors we need to accomplish all those.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Rosendahl, will you be charging anything for these inspections?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the several versions floating around in terms of how the this money will be accomplished, the $750,000 for the program. So I'd have to refresh my memory as to which version you're on.
We're on the $565,000 version.
The Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the 565 is the deficit of the full program cost minus the fees that were put into place last session.
Representative Murphy, anything else?
I'm done. Thank you.
Any questions of the other witness, Ms. Ellison, Representative Paymar?
Ms. Ellison, can you just explain the line 37 of the spreadsheet, how the crime victims, the additional money is going to be appropriated, where it's going?
Ms. Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the $532,000 would be used to restore funding cuts to the judicial districts that are due to experience the greatest funding cuts in 05 versus what they received in 04. So basically that money will go to judicial districts 3, 5, and 7. And I can give you a judicial district map if you would like, but basically 3 is in the southeastern part of the state, 5 is in the southwestern part of the state, and 7 is in the sort of northwestern part or midwestern part of the state.
And this is one time funding then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Ms. Ellison? Otherwise, you can stand down. Mr. Tom Adkins, Washington County Community Corrections, you're also listed.
Good Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tom Adkins. I'm with Washington County Community Corrections. I'm here this morning on behalf of MACAC, the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. And the Community Corrections Act counties currently supervise about three-quarters of the offenders who are in the community under some form of correctional supervision at this time. So when you think of people being on probation or on supervised release, the majority of those offenders are in Community Corrections Act counties. I wanted to come before you, and I will be brief with my comments here this morning, and I'm going to talk in generalities. I do have a short handout I'd like to pass around. As I go through this, the handout has specific numbers on this, and these are numbers that are a point in time. MACAC, as a correctional organization, shares the concerns about public safety in this state, and we support the legislature and the governor in what we're trying to do to make a better and safer community around sex offenders. However, we are also painfully aware of where the weak points in our system are as a delivery system. The foundation for public safety, we believe, starts with good community supervision of sex offenders, with the right tools for probation officers to do their jobs. That includes treatment, it includes polygraphs, it includes GPS and those types of tools that we need to be effective in doing our jobs. But the job doesn't get done without probation officers actually doing the supervision. Again, I'm going to round these numbers off because it's easier to talk about these numbers. There are presently over 14,000 registered sex offenders in this state. Under correctional supervision, there's about 4,600 of them that we're actually supervising in some form of either supervised release or probation. Of the 4,600 on some kind of community supervision, we have about 500, a little over 500, under 600 of them, 563 to be exact, that are on supervised release. So we have over 4,000 on probation, under 600 on supervised release. The level 3 sex offenders that have been discussed at great length, and I know that you're taking great steps to try and deal with them, and I also understand that you're under very tight budget constraints given the money that is available. We're talking about 67 of them are in some form of supervision when we put these numbers together earlier this year. So if you start to narrow that down, you begin to see a very big piece of the pie is under some form of community supervision other than a level 3 sex offender. A number of these sex offenders are very serious sex offenders. We don't just come up with a level 3 sex offender, they don't just pop up in our system. We identify them through supervision, through assessment, through treatment, and eventually through commitments to prison. Most of the sex offenders are dealt with on probation, as you can see from this graph and the numbers available there. As we're dealing with them, the ones who end up being committed to the Commissioner of Corrections and placed in prison are usually identified through some past offense. They don't necessarily start with a first offense. A CrimSex 2 or 3 sex offender on a first time is not going to go to prison. They're going to be a downward departure and be placed on probation. They're likely to do time in our county jail, and we're going to be dealing with them there. So if you think about a CrimSex 2 needing at least 3 criminal history points to get to the point where there are sentencing guidelines put into the Commissioner of Corrections, you realize that the volume of sex offenders are really in the communities at that point in time. We are not in as good a shape as we were last year to deal with these people at this time. The counties are now picking up the funding for psychosexual evaluations, which is a very important part of the front end of this system. If we don't evaluate that sex offender on the front end, we don't know their patterns and their profiles, and we don't know how to protect the community nearly as well if we don't have that evaluation. That state funding went away. I understand that. The counties are doing the best they can to pick that up at this point, and so we're trying to be effective at providing that assessment on the front end of the system. Once we get most of the county-level probation clients end up in some form of treatment, but we're struggling to keep up with the treatment dollars at that point in time. So as I look at the approach to dealing with sex offenders, MACAC's concerns at this point are that the volume of them aren't being addressed because they're not on supervised release. If you look at somebody who's going into prison for 9 years, they're probably going to do about 3 years of that on some form of community supervision. The first year of that is likely to be under intensive supervised release. The next 2 years won't be, and the 5 years of conditional release after that won't be. So if we had that person for 8 years, well, one of those will be under intensive supervision. So I see money for intensive supervised release, and that's good, and I think that's a very important aspect of this. But without money for the treatment of sex offenders, without money for the assessment of sex offenders, and without money for community supervision, we're struggling to deal with that. The response in Washington County, we have, just to give you an example, we have 193 adult sex offenders under supervision when we did a point in time look at this. Of that, there were zero level 3 sex offenders. We didn't have a single level 3 sex offender. We had about 18 sex offenders identified with a level 1 or 2. The remainder of them were on some form of county probation back in the county. Some of them are very serious sex offenders. One of the ones that just came to our attention the other day was I was consulted with about what to do about treatment. This individual had some mental health issues, was living in a halfway house type setting for mental health issues, was on probation for a sex offense, not a committable sentence, sex offense again with the guidelines. However, the person was clearly having direct fantasies about raping the staff and raping residents. So we end up with this individual now on probation in a hospital setting, very expensive setting where we're trying to deal with the mental health issues, and then we're looking at how to manage that individual who hasn't done anything yet but may very well do something in the near future. So to assume that the only serious sex offenders are level 3s leaves us short. But our response last year when we reduced our staffing levels was to reduce our contact standards in some of our areas. Now, we've tried not to do that on the high end, but we had to reduce with an awful lot of folks how often we see them. And so that is a concern as we go forward in this at this point in time. The GPS monitoring, I think you'd find that the probation departments are very supportive of GPS monitoring, but I want to make sure that we're clear that it is not a panacea for our solutions at this point in time. It has problems in rural areas with coverage. It has problems in metro areas with coverage. And most importantly, it produces information that puts a responsibility on us to follow up. Probation departments have not been funded or geared up to deal with a three-shift model. We're not a 24/7 operation. And in order to, if we have those reports on those folks, we need to follow up to know what's happening. To know that an offender goes from point A to point D and gets there is one piece of it, but to know that they're stopping on a corner and not follow up and check about why they're stopping on that corner on a regular basis creates a concern for us. So it's a staff-intensive piece. I wish I could say that it was something that would solve our problems. It adds to our arsenal of tools to try and do the job, and it could be a very effective tool, but it requires staff time to do that. The use of polygraphs has become a very effective tool for us as we move forward and try and deal with people, whether they're in treatment or under supervision, and I'm glad to see that there's been support at different levels for the use of polygraphs. If I can shift gears with you, I'm going to close my comments on the sex offender issue to an extent. The other issue that we're dealing with is methamphetamine, and I know that you've done a number of things to deal with methamphetamine as a committee as you move forward. I just want to make sure that we don't forget the fact that the methamphetamine user who is dependent has presented a whole new problem for us in our probation area. And from the Association of Minnesota Counties perspective, it's an area that's fallen heavily on the counties for funding of that. And I do see in both this body's actions and in the governor's plans to deal with methamphetamine in terms of funding the issues at the state level. I don't see anything on the county level at this point in time. One of the concerns with the methamphetamine user is that these folks deplete their chemicals that give them reasonable happiness in their lives when they use that chemical. And so unlike the traditional person who's chemically dependent, we dry them out, we get them back on track, and we deal with them and put them back on the streets. These folks will take 6 to 9 months, is what the professionals are telling us, before they can experience the joy that you experience by going to your son's or your grandson's hockey game or your daughter's wedding or anything else like that. They physically are unable to experience that kind of joy again, according to psychiatrists. It presents a whole new problem. So at the time when we've seen a reduction in our Tier 2 Rule 25 funding for chemical dependency, which is our working board, we're also seeing this new type of methamphetamine user, and so we would just want to make sure that we don't forget that that treatment in the community is a very important part of what we do. I will close my comments there and be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions at this time? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Adkins, would you agree with me that the community corrections or the county's focus on sex offenders at present has resulted in a drain of resources towards that issue at the expense of some of the other felony and gross misdemeanor caseloads?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I would agree. Sex offenders are not our only serious offenders. Matter of fact, in Washington County, domestic abuse offenders probably present a bigger risk to our community and our citizens than the sex offenders themselves do based on the numbers that we see. There are other serious offenders. We have specialized a caseload around sex offenders. We have not specialized a caseload around high-risk offenders per se, other than our intensive supervision. And we are trying to do the best we can. But yes, that is a big concern for us.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you.
Stephen Sawyer, Executive Director, Project Pathfinder.
Good morning. My name is Steve Sawyer. I'm Executive Director of Project Pathfinder. We're a private nonprofit agency located in St. Paul. I'm a clinical social worker, and I've been treating adult sex offenders for the last 20-some years. I have two comments specifically about language in the bill, and then I have a broader public policy observation. In the introduction, Article 2, it looks to me like your language is targeting those offenders that are going to prison. And one of the issues in public policy is that we tend to use a blanket label like sex offender. And I'm proposing that, for example, in line 17, qualifying language be added, that some offenders are particularly likely to continue to be dangerous. Or in line 22, the legislature believes that some or most or many sex offenders need long-term supervision. I'll come to my observation about recidivism rates in a minute to explain this better. Or even in line 24, for the group of sex offenders that need to go to prison, correctional facility treatment and public safety warrants the use of state resources. The other comment about the bill in particular, I heard a comment the other day regarding the criminal sexual conduct first degree penalty. I believe that's Article 2, Section 16 on page 17. And the observation was made that if a 20-year-old was sexual with a 15-year-old, he could possibly be sent to prison for life. The reality is, in outpatient treatment programs, where the majority of sex offenders are treated, young men of this who have committed this kind of offense are successfully treated in the community. And I'm questioning whether life imprisonment for all cases is the right public policy. There may be opportunities for successful intervention with treatment and appropriate supervision where that would be the best intervention for the community to think about. My public policy observation is a bit about perspective. We know that not all sex offenders go to prison, and not all sex offenders could go to prison. We also know that, as Mr. Atkins said a few minutes ago, the majority of convicted sex offenders are in the community, and the majority in the under the current system that are sent to prison return to the community. We also know that many sex crimes cases are not reported. My observation is that this type of legislation addresses a slice of the entire population of convicted sex offenders. It does not address the entire population of all sex offenders, and certainly does not take on the issue of prevention. We're starting to work on the idea of prevention in Minnesota. There's a coalition of nonprofit groups and public agencies that are working on a public health approach to prevention. Part of the basis of this is that we see studies in the literature that say that recidivism rates around 10%, 20%, in some studies 30%, are representative of what the literature tells us. There's a huge study done by a collaboration that found treated sex offenders reoffended at the rate of 12%. Another study found reoffense rates around 13%. My point is this. Some sex offenders do need to be locked up. Some cannot be rehabilitated, but many can be rehabilitated, and in Minnesota, many are being rehabilitated successfully. And I'm asking that we consider the whole problem as we look at the worst of the worst in some of this legislation. We ought also be looking at the rest of the puzzle, which is a vast majority of all sex offenders. I'll end my comments there.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, Mr. Jim Haas, Minnesota Corrections Association.
Good Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sherry Munyon, and unfortunately, Jim Haas got detained with county business this morning, and he was unable to be here. I'll be very brief, but I do want to make a couple of comments on behalf of the Minnesota Corrections Association. I think that Mr. Haas's comments would have very much mirrored what you heard already from Tom Adkins. We have some very serious concerns about funding for supervision, funding including evaluations, pretrial supervision, post-conviction supervision, and treatment. An example of one of our counties having sex offender caseloads with three supervisors. One has a caseload of 54 sex offenders, one of 56, and the other of 58. Each of those three supervisors carries 10 level 3 offenders on their caseload. And whether we're speaking of sex offenders, drug offenders, or DWI offenders, our supervision funds are very much lacking. Further, since our counties have differing needs, one county may find that it has a high level of sex offenders, another county may find themselves dealing with a high level of DWI or drug offenders. As we look to the future, the long-term solution is overall general caseload reduction. And we certainly look forward to working with the chairman and the committee members and administration as they prepare the next budget to try to resolve caseload issues.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Munyon. Any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not certain that you're the proper person to ask this question, but it's my understanding that there's the requirement that level threes, you have to be supervised in no larger groups than 15 by probation officers. Now, what happens in the event that there is a shortage of probation officers and an additional level three who needs a high level of supervision gets out and needs to go in that group? I've heard that what happens is even if the person's not ready, that the one who needs the least amount of supervision is bumped from that list to bring them into compliance with the 15. Do you know if that's happening, or can you address that issue?
Munyon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not certain that I can. I do know that from talking to probation officers where they have the high caseloads, they will take some of those at the lowest level and sometimes have group meetings with them or have telephone checks in with them instead of the weekly visits.
Anything? Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen, no, we've got now. Bruce Beneke, you've asked to speak.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Bruce Beneke, and I'm the Director of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services and representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition, which together provides statewide service throughout the state of Minnesota. I'd like to talk a little bit about the impact of the proposed cuts to civil legal services in the appropriations bill. Before doing that, I realize that these are hard budget times. I had expected likely a small increase, or decrease, I should say. I was a little surprised to see that civil legal services was singled out while other aspects of the court system were treated differently. Last session, this committee and the legislature treated civil legal services the same as the rest of the court system and the cuts, and we're very grateful for that, and so I guess I was caught a little off guard to see that of all the things in the budget that perhaps civil legal services was singled out the most. A couple thoughts on the impact of it, and then I'll be happy to stand for questions. I understand that this is the first step in a long process, and I'm very appreciative and respectful of this committee's support in the past. And I understand that different houses have different priorities and that those things eventually play out. And I'm respectful of that, and I'm very hopeful and optimistic that this committee, once again in the long run, will treat legal aid with the fairness and bipartisan support that it always has and for which I'm most grateful. As we go through this process, some positives about legal aid that I'd like to ask you to keep in mind as we move forward. Legal aid right now has reduced its attorney staff statewide from 178 attorneys to 138 over the past several years. That's a cut of about 22% already. And again, legal aid is statewide. The money is shared statewide on a proportionate poverty basis, so it affects every district in the state of Minnesota pretty much equally. Again, with a cut of this magnitude, if it were to happen, would likely mean the loss of another 15 legal aid lawyers next year, so we would be down, I would imagine, to about 133. I haven't run the math on this because, again, this has come quickly, but I would expect that that's probably over a 30% cut. I think the impact of that kind of reduction, as you all recognize, the statewide commission and legal services in Minnesota, which actually is meeting right now, and some members of this committee have been on it, and we are appreciative they've identified that even at full funding a couple of years ago, legal aid still fell short of having the resources to meet all the unmet needs. So as we move forward, I think it's important to recognize that a cut of $1,500,000 would reduce legal aid's attorney capacity over 30% at a time when the unmet need is already very large and increasing. The second impact that I would mention is that I would expect that between 4,000 and 5,000 low-income persons who currently have access to justice on their critical problems would go without service in the future because of the additional lowering of attorneys available statewide to provide that representation. As you know from previous testimony, the persons most affected by this are children, single-parent families, senior citizens, farmers, immigrants, refugees, and other low-income persons that have nowhere to turn. So legal aid and the service that it provides in Minnesota with state dollars, really, as you look at the individuals, the vulnerable, needy individuals that are impacted, legal aid certainly is the right thing to do. I would encourage you to remember also that legal aid is the smart thing to do. Legal aid annually, as I testified last year, brings into the state at least $18 million. Legal aid annually saves over $5 million in court costs because we screen out so many cases, because we do preventative law, because we negotiate settlements, and you've had judges come in here and testify about how efficient the court proceedings work when legal aid is involved. So some of those savings that legal aid is able to bring to the court system will go by the by if there's an additional cut. Legal aid, I believe last year, prevented homelessness for over 2,000 persons, and as a result, reduced the subsidy for homeless shelters and things by almost $4 million. That savings of nearly $4 million certainly would be impacted to the extent that legal aid could no longer serve persons and prevent homelessness. Legal aid, through its domestic abuse work and family law work, brings in over $4 million a year in child support orders. Most of that money goes to relieve public assistance payments that would otherwise be on the taxpayers. And finally, legal aid brings in from the federal government over $5 million a year in disability benefits and health benefits to relieve the state taxpayers. So it is at least $18 million a year that makes legal aid a good investment and the smart thing to do. And then if you consider the multiplier that we all know happens in the economy when that money is available to be spent at the local level on groceries and housing and everything else, it does have a broader impact in the economy. So as we move forward, I would urge you to remember, as you have in the past, that legal aid is the smart thing to do. And in addition to benefiting the taxpayers and the individual clients, I'd close with indicating and mentioning that legal aid, as has been found by the statewide commission, benefits the broader community in several other ways. Firstly, most of the cases that we handle are people who are in crisis situations and emergency situations. We are able to stabilize families in crisis. As a result of that, we're able to keep kids in school. We all know how important it is to keep kids in school, not having them shifting from school to school. We prevent a lot of domestic abuse from happening. Children and others are prevented from injury and oftentimes saved from really extreme injury or even death by legal aid services. And I think you know the Department of Justice study that indicated that legal aid was the one solid indicator that its availability, if it was available to persons, you could count on a reduction in domestic abuse. Legal aid certainly also helps persons move towards self-sufficiency, be they persons working to move off welfare to self-sufficiency, or farmers trying to stay on the land, or seniors or others. And then finally, a lot of the work we do is preventative law kind of work, keeping people out of the court, empowering people to solve their problems without having to clog the court system. So in many ways, legal aid does benefit the broader community. And I guess the final thing, last year and the year before, we've had 3M folks who work closely with legal aid and are very supportive testify about the benefit of legal aid. And one of the things that they've always said about legal aid is that in terms of the philosophical underpinnings of our democracy, that under the social compact or social contract, when we as individuals give up rights, and as a result, we gain the right to have access to have our grievances redressed and access to the courts. And that's really the job of the whole court system in Minnesota, is access to justice. And I would encourage all of us to remember that equal justice under law is one of the most fundamental values of our democracy and of our way of life. And that's really the job of legal aid, is to help the court carry out this mission of providing access to justice and equal justice under law. So in that very broad philosophical sense, legal aid is also a core essential government service. I'd also just mention in closing that, as you have recognized before, legal aid is an outstanding bargain for the taxpayers. We're very efficient. Our outcomes of our cases are great. We don't ask the state to do it all. We leverage $10 or $12 million of other resources every year. We're positive. We look for solutions. We don't want to be part of the problem. We want to be part of the solution. We will continue to try to do better and to be even more effective and efficient and wise in spending the taxpayers' dollars. I feel, in closing, that given all of your individual support of legal aid in the past, this committee's support, and the fair treatment that legal aid has had, I'm confident and optimistic that as we go forward in this process, this bipartisan tradition of over 20 years of supporting legal aid and access to justice and equal justice will continue. And at the end of the day, when all of this is over, legal aid and access to justice will once again have the support and respect from this committee, which you've given so much in the past, and all of you, and which I very much appreciate. So I'm happy to stand for questions, but that's kind of a quick summary of the positive things that legal aid does and some of the impact that will happen if, in fact, legal aid is cut at the depth that's indicated in the bill. And thank you very much for this opportunity.
At this time, any questions? Representative Paper.
I have a question for you, Representative Smith. Can you explain your rationalization for making this cut? You didn't consult, obviously, with the committee.
I can give you a brief response. Right now, I would prefer to go through the rest of the testimony. We'll have time for discussion later, but I will address your question right now. And in doing so, Mr. Beneke, let me just ask you a couple of friendly questions.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, you always do.
Thank you. I heard you referenced a 30% cut. First of all, we're here dealing with your state funding cuts, not with your sources of funding elsewhere. Your actual state funding cuts, by our calculations, is 21.9%, 21% cut of state funding. That's not 30%. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't have the calculator in front of me. I agree with you. Our total cut from all sources is $3,600,000. The past two sessions, we've been treated fairly. We've ended up, I believe, with a total of 8% cut in our base coming into this session. So this $1,500,000 would be,
Bruce,
I assume, 21% above that.
Bruce, just a few questions.
Okay.
Because I want to answer Representative Paymer's question. I need to lay a base on doing so, that it's, we don't have a 30% cut of your state funds.
No,
it's
you're
a 21% cut, 20 or 21%. I just wanted to clarify that misstatement of yours.
So this $1,500,000 would represent a 21% cut in state funds?
That's right. It's
okay.
Not 30%.
Okay.
Second question is, the state is not your only source of income. You have several other line items of income.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Other public, lawyer fund drive, attorney fees, bar funds. There's a line item that I'm not sure what it references, but you have also corporate grants, the IOLTA account, and other. IOLTA account, just for the record, and those of on this committee who don't know what that is, would you reference and explain the IOLTA account?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chairman, members. IOLTA stands for Interest on Lawyers Trust Accounts, and those accounts that sit in the banks generate small amounts of interest that formerly went to the banks. Supreme Court administers this program, and has been available as part of our leveraging effort to have other sources of funds in addition to the state. Mr. Chairman, one of our problems is because of the interest rate drop, that funding source has dropped about 60% the last couple of years. Again, you're correct to note that that's not a state fund. That is a different source of fund, and we would continue not to ask the state to do it all, but at the same time to recognize that for a variety of reasons, a number of our funding sources, including IOLTA, have been drastically cut over the last couple of years.
And Mr. Beneke, the other public that I referenced, that's in part or maybe all, that's federal, so-called federal dollars, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, the federal dollars are primarily from the Legal Services Corporation.
Do you know offhand the dollar amount?
Offhand, Mr. Chairman, I believe the dollar amount statewide is something over $4 million. I could get that for you. I don't have it in front of me, but actually maybe I can get it out of my file.
You can look for that, but I just have a couple more questions. I may be looking at a year-old sheet of information, but I think they are reflective of your current situation relative to position and also numbers. Isn't it true that the bulk of your funding, if you had it all on the table, over half of it would come from other than Minnesota State tax funds, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So that now this 21%, that it wasn't 30%, but this 21% cut of state funding, when you look at how it is reflected against the entire amount of money, is no longer a 21% cut, but it's a lot closer to about an 8% cut, assuming the flow of other sources. You're only receiving about an 8% cut. That's my calculation. If you haven't had time to calculate that, you may want to do that. But in answering Representative Paymar's question, when you look at your entire pot of money, the reduction of your state funding, which is less than half of what you get anyway, now equates not even 21%, but more like an 8% overall cut. Here's another question. Even in the face of this 8% cut, Minnesota still ranks, does it not, fourth highest of all 50 states in money received from state funds for civil legal services. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I am not sure that's correct anymore. I know that several states have passed increases this year. I haven't seen the national data to know, but I would suspect that, again, this legislature has been very fair to us in recognizing that legal aid is a good investment for everybody in the state and has backed that up, and I certainly appreciate that. Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Beneke, in regard to the ranking of the states, and I'll leave off with any question, and then I'll summarize my answer for now, at least, for Representative Paymar. Minnesota, at what I'm looking at, is fourth highest, surpassed only by New Jersey, California, and Massachusetts. Of the 50 states, 21 provide no funding for their civil legal from state funding. 21 states provide no funding. All other states provide less than Minnesota. Minnesota is in the top four even after this now 8% cut. Recognizing your valuable service to the state, and frankly, I will dispute that this is a core legal service, although it is a good and perhaps even essential service. Whether it's core or not is an issue for debate. This, even with this cut, Representative Paymar, it still leaves civil legal services in the top in Minnesota, in the top four out of 50 states. It still leaves them in this, in the chair's opinion, and I trust when we're through at the end of the day, the committee's opinion, to be adequately funded. And that's the answer you'll get for now. Representative Paymar, anything else at this time?
Well, I'd just like to say, Mr. Chair, that's easy to say. I mean, this just in the last few years, I mean, it's very clear what this legislature's doing, and that is that we're balancing the budget on the poor. And, you know, and you're part of that. I mean, you look at, we were ranked number one, two, or three in the country in terms of funding for child care support. Now we're ranked number 29th. We were ranked number four in 1960 in support for public education. Now we're ranked number 25. We were one of the leaders in crime prevention funding, and now we're slipping down. So, I mean, it's all relative. If you want to race to the bottom, go ahead. But the fact of the matter, you look at this spreadsheet, you're balancing the budget on the backs of the poor. I mean, where would we take it from? I can't even make an amendment at this point, I suspect. You know, it's... The governor and this committee is not making, you know, has not provided sufficient money for the sex offender program. So there's, where do we take it from? You take it from the poorest people who can't afford legal services. That's what you're doing. That's the reality of it. It's easy to say, well, we're number one, two, three in the country, so let's go down to 20, 23 in the country. I think it's unfair. I think it's wrong what we're doing.
Any other questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Beneke. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify this morning? Raise your hand so I can get a count, if any. I see one to my left. I see none over here. Let's take you, sir, if you'd come to the table, and then thank you, Mr. Beneke. Give us your name and... take a few moments and tell us your testimony.
My name is Lamar Hamilton, and I want to testify to these bills. I did 27 years in prison. 27 years in prison. And I'm sitting up here, I'm listening to all of these people talk about these bills and getting money for these sex offenders, and you know, and I'm hurt. I'm let you know that now. I'm really hurt. Because I'm wondering if it's about getting these people off the street or if it's about getting money for a program. 27 years I was in prison. The tax people, I'm glad these people is listening to me. $35,000 a year for me in prison. If I went to treatment, it's 15 more thousand. I went to treatment three times in prison, so that means what? That's $90,000 or something of taxpayers' money? And they talking about putting money into a sex offense program? Giving money to these people, is it about getting these people off the street, or is it about getting money for a program for somebody with a sick mind? I'm asking you guys to quit telling the prison system that you're coming in there. I loved it when you came in there because I ate good. They changed the meal. They gave me steak and potatoes and fried chicken. But when you wasn't there, I ate beans and cornbread, spinach, beets, some kind of stew. I don't know what was in it. But I asked you guys to go in that penitentiary with unannounced and see the real truth about that subnormal world that y'all don't have the slightest idea what y'all playing with right now. I'm hurt that I'm sitting up here listening at a bunch of people from Department of Correction talk about putting money into a program that is no good. They go in there, and if you go in there, you listen to them talk about how, I sit in three treatments. My finger slipped on my 9-month-old baby, and sit in a treatment and listen to somebody talk like this about a 9-month-old baby. This guy, Drew Sedin's husband or boyfriend is here, and he gets up here and expresses to you guys about his feelings about his girlfriend. This guy I know for a fact is he's unrehabilitatable. He got perverted mind because he's looking at the key women inside. If you don't know what a key woman is, that's a police officer who's coming into prison sitting with her legs cocked open and feeding his perverted mind. Wearing tight pants, feeding his perverted mind. That place is a subnormal world, ladies and gentlemen, at these tables. Y'all don't have the slightest idea. San Quentin, Leavenworth, Stringtown, Collins, Joseph R. Lexington, Boley, Helena. What was I in prison for? Burglary? Robbery? I thought every day about somebody breaking in my house. How would I feel? I try to make amends to the people's houses that I broke into, the people that I robbed. I do volunteer work right now with the youth. They trying to stop me from doing that, but I got to tell them the truth. I'm not trying to sell prison to them. This guy get over here talk about sending money to a program for some sex offenders, some people that is predators. I am really disgusted with listening that people talk about sending money to a program that's unsuccessful. If you got a business and that business is 86% successful, you will feed that business. As you and I both know, prison is a 99% revolving door. 99% revolving door. I know. I went back for being on the phone after 10:30. I was violated for being on my phone after 10:30. If you gave me $35,000 a year on these streets, I can make it. Why are we talking about putting money into a sex offense program? Or are we going to talk about getting them off the streets? Them treatments ain't working inside. Please go inside and sit in them programs and listen to some of the stuff that these cats talk about. Please, I beg each and every one of you guys that has the power to put money into a program unsuccessful to go in there, sit down with these predators, and listen at their stories, their true stories. Please do that. And I think that you would have a different perspective about putting money into a program such as sex offense program. I did 27 years. I did my time. I don't glorify nothing that I did. I was wrong for burglary and stealing other people's property. But I'm out here to tell the truth about prison. I'm out here to tell it to these gang members that's doing these drive-bys and these youth. Because that's what I have to do. I don't have no scars on me. That's why I went to all of them different prisons. Because I was a threat for inside a prison. I'm pretty sure if the commissioner was here, she would tell you who Lamar Hamilton was inside. But I'm out here in this society to tell the truth, to deter anybody that's going to listen with an ear about the truth, about that subnormal world, different than any world that these people would ever know out here. I'm sure that these taxpayers peoples up here don't know that they're giving $15,000 every time somebody go into a treatment center inside that prison, plus the $35,000 that they're giving for an inmate to stay in prison 1 year. $35,000 a year. These people don't have the slightest idea where their taxpayers' money is going. And if they get kicked out of treatment, they go back in 30 days, that's $15,000 more. Do they know where their taxpayer money is going? And we steady sitting up here talking about giving money to a sex offense program. Didn't nobody give me no money to go to a burglary program or a robbery program. I did my time behind walls. San Quentin, Leavenworth, Stringtown, Connors, Joseph Harb, Lexington, Boley, Helena, Connors, McAllister, Granite. I was there 17, I forgot how many prisons I was in. But I'm here to tell you people, don't put your money into a sex offense program that is not going to work. Throw the key away. That's what's going to work. They're hurting these people out here. Sit in the program and listen to some of this stuff that they talk about. If you really want to know what a predator is about, sit in one of the programs. Don't go in there telling them that you're coming in there. Don't tell them who you are. Benson did it in Stillwater. He came into Stillwater, he put on inmates' clothes, and walked around the yard and found out the truth about what's going on. It's more dope there than it is on the streets. There's more killing there that you people never hear about. There's all kind of garbage going on. But go in there, sit in one of them programs, and see if your stomach can take what them people is talking about. Or they're victims.
Mr. Hamilton, if you could conclude, and then we can move
Thank
on.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Committee, at this time, the chair is going to move House File 2028 to get it before the committee. Further, the chair will move Amendment H202H, the DE1 amendment, which we previously discussed, to get it also before the committee. On the DE1 amendment, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. 2028 as amended, we're going to immediately go to three of the amendments. The first would be the A15 amendment in your packet. All right, the chair would move the A15 amendment. This is the appropriations. Any discussion on that motion? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. A15 is adopted. We'll move along to the A22. Strike that, the A28-2 amendment.
A what?
A28-2. Chair will move the A28-2 amendment. I'd like an explanation of this amendment. This amendment was prepared to move the non-aggravated criminal sexual conduct first-degree offenses out of the life without parole category and into the indeterminate structure. On the A28-2 amendment. Representative Strong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to indicate I do appreciate the amendment, and I think we've had discussions about this in our committee and issues raised by members who brought up the examples of age differences while not sending the message that that's not serious. I think this sends the message that this bill focuses on the worst of the worst. Sort of consistent with what the last witness was talking about, locking up the worst of the worst, but not necessarily getting over into that area of non-aggravated offenses, maybe age-related offenses, as Representative Ellison has mentioned. I appreciate the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, a lot of things to have to focus on this morning. As I understand the amendment, I would support it because I think it gives us all the public safety guarantees that we're looking for the serious offenders,
right.
But it does add in some flexibility, and so I want to speak up on behalf of the amendment and urge members' support.
Thank you, Representative Ellison. Anything further? Any other questions, any discussion on the amendment? On the amendment, 828-2, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. That one's adopted. We're going to take up a third amendment at this time, the A22 amendment. Representative Strawn.
Mr. Chair, first of all, with your permission, I'd like to have Representative Murphy co-author this.
Move the,
I'll move the amendment.
I apologize. You go ahead with what you were going to say. Go ahead.
I would move the amendment, and if I could I have Representative Murphy co-author the amendment with me, and I'd also, respective of the fact that a constituent of hers would like to testify, I can have her introduce that witness.
Representative Murphy, is that agreeable with you?
Thank you. Yes.
All right. Okay, your witness then.
Alida Granholm is here, and an incident, terrible accident happened when she and her husband and the Esco Fire Department were responding to an accident on the highway, and she has been one of the main sponsors of this type of legislation before us for 2-3 years now.
Welcome to this committee, ma'am. There's a public record being made. Would you give us your name and then tell us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Alina Granholm, and today I'd like to share a tragic accident that forever changed my life 20 months ago. Monday, July 1st, 2002, should have been like any other Monday. I would rise to go to work while my husband, Captain Kim Granholm, stayed home with our two daughters. However, this particular day started out with the emergency tones sounding off at approximately 7 a.m. Report of a car fire on Interstate I-35. Both my husband and I bounded out of bed and quickly dressed. Off to the fire hall we head for yet another call for help. Little did we know that this would be Kim's last run. Captain Kim Allen Granholm was a firefighter, first responder with the Esco Volunteer Fire Department. His love for the department and helping others was obvious in the many hours he spent at the fire hall and the number of runs and trainings he attended. Because of his dedication and willingness to always be there, he was promoted to the rank of captain in just under 4 years. At the time, I was just a rookie. I had just joined the department in December of 2001. We were the first husband-wife duo in the 53-year department history, and I was the second female to join the ranks. That July morning, there wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was going to be another glorious summer day. Dispatch reported that the driver had extinguished the fire but would like further assistance. Once Kim and I arrived at the fire hall, one truck was already en route. Our fire chief directed us to head out with another truck. With flashing lights, we pulled up a safe distance behind. This was a routine call. We knew our jobs and how important it was to get in there, do our job, and get off the freeway. Lives were at risk. With 7 emergency responders, including one law enforcement official and the driver of the car, we finished quickly. The paperwork had just been completed when the unthinkable happened. One inattentive driver rear-ended another inattentive driver, causing the first vehicle to ricochet into our scene at approximately 45 miles per hour. When all came to a stop, only 3 emergency workers remained standing. 2 emergency workers were thrown in excess of 30 feet in 2 different directions. Another was thrown and knocked unconscious not far from the side of the road. And Kim laid on the road next to the car, almost dead. In addition, we had 2 injured and traumatized drivers. The driver who caused the accident escaped injury. A cry for help echoed back at the fire hall. Chief Jutton arrived with a rescue truck and blocked both lanes of traffic. Luckily, he looked outside the side, looked in the side mirror before stepping out of the truck. An impatient driver drove through the grassy median to get around the rig. Had Chief Jutton not taken a moment to look, he too would have been lying on the side of the road. Kim was airlifted to the hospital. Emergency personnel did all that they could to save him on the scene. His injuries were too severe. He died in surgery due to a ruptured aorta. Emergency workers, including firefighters, EMS personnel, law enforcement, and even tow truck operators, risk their lives each and every day. But there's no greater risk than being at an accident scene on the highways with vehicles speeding past within close proximity. The fire service alone has seen 4 fatalities along Minnesota highways in the past several years. This does not take into account the number of deaths within law enforcement. Unfortunately, some of these accidents were caused by careless, inattentive, uninformed drivers. Today's drivers are well aware of strict DOT work zone laws. The public is inundated with public service announcements warning them to slow down in work zones or face double the fines. Blaze orange DOT billboards along our highways echo the same message. Yet, the same cannot be said for emergency service zones. Very few drivers are aware of the law requiring them to move over to the adjacent lane when approaching an emergency scene. This lack of public information is a portion of the problem. Emergency personnel deserves the same commitment in educating the public. It is proven that billboards and public service announcements work for the DOT, as they have not suffered a fatality in 10 years. Please bring this curriculum to the classroom by means of driver's education training. Teach the
proper driving behaviors when passing an emergency scene. Educate drivers with the knowledge that not only are their lives in our hands, our lives are in theirs. I urge you to impose stricter penalties. Currently, it is a misdemeanor fine if you're caught not moving to the adjacent lane when passing an emergency zine. This is just a slap on the hand when you consider the number of lives they put at risk by not moving over and slowing down. People go to great extents to return a video on time to avoid a measly $4 late fee, yet they don't think twice about slowing down in an emergency zone because they are not educated on the rules of the road. Only when the consequences become severe enough will people start abiding. In conclusion, I ask you to support the Highway Safety Bill to further prevent another tragedy such as mine from occurring. Our emergency responders need to be able to work in a safe zone. I understand the state's budget crunch, and yes, this bill is going to take a little money and some time. But tell me, how much is the life of a hero worth in our eyes?
Thank you, Ms. Granhor. Representative Murphy, anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Grace, the executive director of the fire chief, is here too, but I don't know if you have anything additional. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
On the A22 amendment discussion, if not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. That is adopted. We'll go to the A1 amendment. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair,
you can do it right there if you want, yeah.
Mr. Chair, this is a portion of the DNA evidence statute that was proposed by the Innocence Project. I made some changes to it, though, because people were nervous about how much stuff we were going to keep in police departments and with the BCA. So in conversations with the BCA and with Representative Strand, who was really helpful, we came up with a solution that I think was palatable for everyone, and I'll explain it further. But in order to do that, I need to make an oral amendment to the A1 amendment.
Go ahead.
Okay, it would be on line 11, after the period, a new sentence. The governmental entity need retain only the portion of such evidence as was used to obtain an accurate biological sample and used to obtain a conviction.
Does staff have that addition? Read it one more time.
The governmental entity need retain only the portion of such evidence as was used to obtain an accurate biological sample and used to obtain a conviction.
Staff now have the addition.
Mr. Chair, by way of explanation, folks got nervous about this amendment when there was the concern that the BCA or local law enforcement authorities would have to be retaining large boxes of bedding, coats, clothing, jackets, that type of thing, which they did not have the capacity to do. However, BCA is currently retaining on its own those small biological samples on swatches of clothing, on Q-tips, in test tubes, which are able to be retained, and which would this amendment would enshrine for us to be doing that.